549. Good evening. This is Examine Life. I'm Steve. Pat won't be with us tonight, so you'll be stuck with me again. And it is July 4th tomorrow, which is Independence Day for the United States of America. So on the eve of our celebration of the great experiment that is the Representative Republic of the United States of America, I'm going to talk about America, the struggle for independence, and why we should celebrate its existence. Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Tonight I want to talk about, first about the Independence Day itself and what it was about. What was the American Revolution about? And I hope those of you who are listening know a little bit about history. We've found over the years that most people don't pay attention, and you get some very interesting responses when you ask people on the street questions like, when did we win our independence? You get the most incredibly crazy answers. And what's really sad is all the information is out there today, so there's no reason for a person to be ignorant of this. The people who lived in America at the time of prior to the American Revolution were only interested in building their lives. Politics wasn't important to most of them, so long as they could pursue their goals. What led to the Revolutionary War? Before it was the United States, those people were there because they had fled tyranny, or they wanted freedom to practice their religion without interference by government. Or they had a dream and believed that the blank slate of the New World was a place to build that dream. There were a thousand other reasons. If you came to America, unless you were an indentured servant or under the inhuman practice of slavery, you were free to do almost anything, and if you were willing to work hard enough and fight for your own place. But isn't that what all life on planet Earth has been about from the beginning of time? It's about the struggle, and the struggle is what makes us who we are and tells us who we are. And America is the perfect platform for that, at least it was back then. So this meant that the American people were strongly independent. They wanted to do things for themselves. They didn't want anyone else telling them what to do. Great Britain was a long ways away, and the American people didn't want people an ocean away telling them how to live their lives, telling them that they owed them money for things that they never saw, for telling them what they could and couldn't do through pretty much all aspects of their life. But with the British crown's funds were depleted by the French and Indian War, which had happened previous to this, and they ostensibly, you know, their statement was that they were protecting the people who lived in America by fighting that war, and so they decided that the people in America should pay the bills. And the government saw the energy and the value of the new land, and as all entrenched government bureaucracies do, they decided to use the resources of the American colonies to fund a large share of the debt from that war. They just saw kind of a golden pot there, and they did things like the Sugar Act, which was designed to restrict trade with other countries other than Britain. So that the Americans could only trade with British companies or companies and countries that Britain approved of. There was the Stamp Act, which was an act of the Parliament of Great Britain that imposed a direct tax on the colonies of British America, and it required that many printed materials in the colonies had to be produced on a stamped paper that was made in London that carried an embossed revenue stamp, and of course they had to pay for that, and other taxes as well. And the British tried to collect taxes that the American people, again, they weren't American citizens yet. We didn't have a country, but the people living there thought that they were harsh and overdone. They also, the American people, that is, thought that they should be able to send their own people to Britain's Parliament or at least vote for Britain's lawmakers. But, of course, Britain disagreed. They were just colonists, right? The combination of those harsh taxes and the lack of an American voice in Parliament gave rise to the famous phrase, taxation without representation. The state of Jefferson, that's the complaint that we have here in Northern California, that with all the representation in California, we have a very large geographical part of California with a lot of people in counties and very minimal representation at the state capitol. So consequently, we really have no say in what happens. And all those taxes and decisions by the state do roll down to us. So it's why the people who are in support of the state of Jefferson are. So Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine, and others called for an independent America, but that wasn't popular at the time. People just wanted to have some of these harsh taxes and some of this, you know, where you had to allow the British military in your home, whether you wanted them there or not. Things like that. They just wanted some easing up of that kind of stuff, but they were willing to be British, continue to be British subjects. So Patrick Henry and Thomas Paine and the others who wanted independence were kind of the fringe at that time. Americans, though, started stockpiling guns and ammunition. And, of course, British laws didn't allow that, so they were in violation of British law. Their defense of such a stockpile led to the shots fired at Lexington and Concord. The battle that subsequently caused the Boston Massacre and things like that that led up to the war. And when an armed conflict between bands of American colonists and British soldiers began in April of 1775, the Americans were, again, only fighting for their rights as subjects of the British Crown. In 1774, the First Continental Congress was formed, and among other things, a ban was implemented on buying British goods. And what was meant by that was that they put a lot of restrictions so that the colonists themselves, so that people would not buy British goods. It was kind of a way of starting the war economically. And they, of course, didn't have a lot of cooperation because probably a lot of people liked British goods. But they did try to proscribe it, and they continued working on that ban and became more effective later on. And then, of course, in 1775, George Washington was named commander of the American forces. Now, he had never commanded a large army in the field before. He was a member of the Continental Congress, and that was part of the reason why they chose him. He was actually the only one, or the one that had the most military leadership experience in the Continental Congress. And so he was the one that they wanted to have in charge of the Continental Army, because being a member of the Continental Congress, it gave him more authority than just being named a general. If you were in Boston at the time of the Boston Massacre, I'm going to read you an excerpt from the newspaper during the Boston Massacre. A few minutes after 9 o'clock, four youths named Edward Archibald, William Merchant, Francis Archibald, and John Leach, Jr. came down Cornhill together and, separating at Dr. Loring's corner, the two former were passing the narrow alley leading Mr. Murray's barrack, in which a soldier brandishing a sword of an uncommon size against the walls, out of which he struck fire plentifully. I'm assuming they're talking about sparks. A person of mean countenance, armed with a large cudgel, bore him company. Edward Archibald admonished Mr. Merchant to take care of the sword, on which the soldier turned round and struck Archibald on the arm, then pushed at Merchant and pierced through his clothes inside the arm close to the armpit and grazed the skin. Merchant then struck the soldier with a short stick he had, and the other person ran to the barrack and brought with him two soldiers, one armed with a pair of tongs and the other with a shovel. The one with the tongs pursued Archibald back through the alley, collared and laid him over the head with the tongs. The noise brought people together, and John Hicks, a young lad, coming up, knocked the soldier down but let him get up again, and more lads gathering drove them back to the barrack where the boys stood some time, as it were, to keep them in. In less than a minute, 10 or 12 of them came out with drawn cutlasses, clubs, and bayonets, and set upon the unarmed boys and the young folk, who stood them a little while, but finding the inequality of their equipment, they dispersed. So essentially, these British were armed, and of course the local people were not, and it just started as a scuffle. But in the end of this scuffle, there were about 30 or 40 people gathered in King Street, and there was Captain Preston with a party of men that had charged bayonets, and they had come from the commissioner's house. And they ended up, 3 men laid dead on the spot and 2 more struggling for life. And this was an excerpt from the newspaper, which was printed the next day. But what showed a degree of cruelty unknown to British troops, at least since the House of Hanover has directed their operation, was an attempt to fire upon or push with their bayonets the persons who undertook to remove the slain and wounded. So the British were pretty vicious at this time, or at least certain segments of them were. And this is the way that people were manhandled by the British, and it's what led to the Revolutionary War. After George Washington was named commander of the American forces, he had to fight the war until 1783. And I think he saw his beloved estate one time recently after being appointed commander, and after that it was 6 more years before he was able to return home. He had never commanded a large army. And what always amazes me is that the British military was probably considered the most powerful military in the world, and he lost more battles than he won, and in the first year he lost a lot of battles. He almost lost his whole army in a single battle of New York, but through a very slick move and just a lot of military genius, he managed to save his whole 9,000-man army and escape. The Revolutionary War would have probably been over in that battle if he had not managed to escape like that. And he did something totally unexpected, which involved a lot of boats, which is similar to what he did when he crossed the Delaware. And he had to hold together a tenuous army amid threats of disintegration and failure, and he had to fight against, again, the most powerful military in the world. His troops were from all over the colonies. They had differing views of the world and religion and government and even what the whole purpose of this Revolutionary War was for. And he managed to do all of that. These men had to leave their families. They didn't have Skype. They didn't have ways that they could, you know, communicate with their families. They had no food on many occasions. They had no boots sometimes in the middle of winter. They were always running out of ammunition. At first, they lost more battles than they won. When it was all over, Washington tried to retire, but Congress talked him into being the first president, and I believe he was unwillingly that president twice. Even after the initial battles in the Revolutionary War broke out, only a few colonists desired complete independence from Great Britain. And those who did, like John Adams, were considered radical. But things changed over the course of the next year as Britain attempted to crush the rebels with all the force of its great army. In his message to Parliament in October of 1775, King George III rallied against the rebellious colonies and ordered the enlargement of the Royal Army and the Navy. News of his words reached America in 1776, and that just strengthened the radicals' cause, and leading many conservatives who wanted to remain British subjects to abandon their hopes of reconciliation. And with the Revolutionary War in full swing, the movement for independence from Britain had grown, and delegates of the Continental Congress were faced with a vote on the issue. In mid-June 1776, a 5-man committee, including Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin, was tasked with drafting a formal statement of the colony's intentions. That declaration was finalized on July 2nd, but the Congress didn't formally adopt the Declaration of Independence, which was largely actually written only by Jefferson, in Philadelphia on July 4th, which is why the date is now celebrated as the birth of American independence. And You know, this nation was an incredible, incredible experiment. I'm going to talk a little more about that later, but just look at what happened to us just in the first 100 years, what America became. I'm going to take a little bit of a break, and then I'm going to return and talk a little bit more, read a little part of the Declaration of Independence, and after that we'll talk a little bit more about America itself.
We took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run in on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise. If we didn't fire a musket, still we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we see their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it. Well, down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them. On down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We fired our cannon till the barrel melted down. So we grabbed an alligator and we fought another round. We filled his head with cannonballs and powdered his behind. And when we touched the powder off, the gator lost his mind. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, that was the Battle of New Orleans, which actually was not in the Revolutionary War. It was in the War of 1812, which was also between America and Great Britain. And it was about Andrew Jackson, who later became president, commanding soldiers on a battle that was expected to end in disaster and actually ended the other way around. So I want to talk a little bit about... Bear with me here. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. In the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, he wrote, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. This outlines a general philosophy of government that justifies revolution when government harms natural rights. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And I'm going to discuss in a little while those three inalienable rights and what they really should mean. And if you have thoughts about what I say, I would appreciate emailing me at examinelife@peoplepc.com. That's examinelife@peoplepc.com. And let me take a moment here to remind you that you're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain, and we are community-supported radio, which means you, the community, should decide what's on the air and also should support the local station. We played that song from the War of 1812, so I'm going to briefly talk about that war because that was basically the next war after the Revolutionary War. We're not going to go into all of them tonight. But during the War of 1812, the British again harassed Americans. During this war, the President's house was burned down by British forces. Britain was fighting a brutal war against Napoleon, and once again, Americans were caught in the middle. American sailors were kidnapped and impressed into the British Navy against their will. There were trading issues with both the French and the British Americans, still a fledgling nation. And that we had to go to war again to protect, or not we today, but they had to go to war again to protect their personal rights and the right to their commerce in the world. The British were trying to prevent them again from interacting with other nations that they didn't approve of. The end of that war saw America gaining very little of what they actually entered the war for, but the war did serve to help America begin to feel its strength and its place in the world. And of course, the song you heard just a few minutes ago was about the Battle of New Orleans, which was during that war. And also, the American anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, was written during the War of 1812 as well. I want to talk a little bit about that song. It was because a battle struck a person so intently that they had to write about it. It was a rainy September 13th in 1814, and British warships sent a downpour of shells and rockets onto Fort McHenry in the Baltimore Harbor. They were relentlessly pounding the American fort for 25 hours straight. The bombardment, known as the Battle of Baltimore, came only weeks after the British had attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol, the Treasury, and the President's house. It was another chapter in their ongoing war of 1812. And a week earlier, Francis Scott Key, who was a 35-year-old American lawyer, had boarded the flagship of the British fleet on the Chesapeake Bay in the hopes of persuading the British to release a friend who had recently been arrested. Key's tactics were successful, but because he and his companions had gained knowledge of the impending attack on Baltimore, the British did not want to let them go. They finally allowed the Americans to return to their own vessel, but continued guarding them on that vessel. Under that scrutiny, Key watched on September 13th as a barrage of Fort McHenry began 8 miles away. Key said, and I quote, "It seemed as though Mother Earth had opened and was vomiting shot and shell in a sheet of fire and brimstone. But when darkness arrived, Key saw only red erupting in the night sky. Giving the scale of the attack, he was certain the British would win. The hours passed very slowly, but in the clearing smoke of the dawn's early light, on September 14th, he saw the American flag, not the British Union Jack, flying over the fort, announcing an American victory." Key put his thoughts on paper while still on board the ship, setting his words to the tune of a popular English song. His brother-in-law, commander of a militia at Fort McHenry, read Key's work and had it distributed under the name Defense of Fort McHenry. The Baltimore Patriot newspaper soon printed it, and within weeks Key's poem, is now called The Star-Spangled Banner, was in print across the country, immortalizing his words and forever naming the flag that it celebrated. That battle struck him so intently, and others, too, that also talked about it, that he had to write that poem. And, of course, now we sing that as the Star-Spangled Banner. So the Declaration of Independence, what was it about? Well, we should start with the primary definitive word, independence. Most Americans were very independent, and they wanted to stay that way prior to the United States of America. That didn't mean they didn't want to socialize. It didn't mean that they didn't want to help one another. It meant just exactly what the word means. Each one pursued his or her happiness on their own efforts. If they truly physically could not feed themselves, generally their neighbors helped them. They didn't have their pursuit of happiness made for them because they had some pain or they weren't too smart. There were always things people could do or people who were smarter than them that they could work for. The America's always had leaders. It's always had people who would rather be employees. It's always had people who would rather be employers. That's the natural way. We don't all need to be equal, and we shouldn't all be equal, and we're not biochemically all born equal. But everybody has an opportunity to build their life within the capacities that they have or they try to build. The community of these people didn't let them starve, but if they wanted more, they had to pursue it. Everything wasn't given to them. They just were protected from starvation. And by giving of their own resources, their friends and neighbors were sure they didn't abuse what they were given. America is the most compassionate and giving nation in the world, and I don't mean the government. I mean the American people. Generally, when there's a disaster somewhere in the world, it's the American people who give more money than the American government does. And it's because that's what freedom does. That tendency to give has dropped since we've become more and more socialized, but it's always been there. And it's not always just religious people that do that. It's people of all cultures and all types who tend to be charitable when they have freedom and when they've worked hard for what they themselves have. So let's talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The first right is life. What does the right to life mean? Does it mean that life should be guaranteed? Can anybody guarantee that you'll have life? I mean, you can do something that will cause you to get killed, or, a comet, a meteorite could fall on your head, or you could have a heart attack, or there's a lot of things that can happen to someone. A lot of them we do to ourselves. So your right to life, when it says the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it means that the only possibility must be that people simply have a right to live that is not infringed upon by government or actively taken by another person. Let's say a person has an illness, and a medical professional may have the ability to try to cure it, but wants to charge a large fee to do it. Whose rights prevail? The medical professional's pursuit of happiness or the patient's right to life? The preamble of the Constitution doesn't prioritize these inherent rights. If the physician does help the patient, and then they choose an unhealthy lifestyle, should that person be punished for endangering their own life? So the right to life is basically, they meant that no one could take your life from you. They left the responsibility for keeping it otherwise up to each person's fortunes and their efforts. Liberty. What is the meaning of liberty? That's a big one. Does liberty mean that a person should not be allowed to fail? No, that's pretty much helicopter parenting. That's one of our problems today, is we don't allow children to experience failure. Does liberty mean that citizens should be forced to give up their own resources to take care of those who are less fortunate? No, that's an action that we all should try to take for the sake of our own evolution. But if it is forced, it isn't charity. It's taking from one person's pursuit of happiness and giving to another's. Is that liberty? Does liberty mean that a group of people, no matter how large or how small, should be allowed to decide how we all should think or what we should say? No, that's fascism. Does liberty have a formula for how much money a person should legally acquire during their lifetime? Not one that I'm aware of. When I have a discussion with people and they tell me that a rich person has too much money, the obvious question is, how much would they consider to be not too much? But then the numbers get a little vague. And in fact, there is no answer to that question. Someone could arbitrarily come up with a dollar amount, but I don't know if they would hold that dollar amount for themselves if they were given an opportunity to have more for, more of that. So the right to liberty is the right to make your own choices, the right to succeed or to fail. And everyone will have good luck and bad luck. And when you have bad luck, you pick yourself up and you try to turn it into good luck. But it's liberty. Liberty means the freedom to do as you will, as long as you don't infringe on someone else's rights or take away their liberty or their pursuit of happiness or their life. So what is the pursuit of happiness? The word pursuit means an action to chase or go after something. Responsibility for using them properly relies on the individual, not on anyone around them in their circle or the wider circle, and certainly not for any bureaucrat. The responsibility is the true cost of freedom. And that cost is how we grow as human beings. Freedom and liberty mean just that. You're free to act as you will. You are at liberty to succeed or to fail. You're free to try again. You're free to make decisions about your own life and reap the rewards or penalties. The most destructive things a parent can do is to not allow their child to learn about the rules of life, to never allow their child to suffer consequences from bad choices or decisions, to not make a child do chores to earn their place in the household so they can learn the value of providing for yourself. Childhood has a purpose. Toys are imitations of real objects used in adult life. There's a reason for that. The purpose of childhood is to learn about how to be an adult. Sure, you can play and have fun, but essentially what you're doing is you're learning how to be an adult. It's to learn how to be responsible for your own life. Why do writers and producers make stories about people overcoming obstacles against all odds on their own resources? Because that's where the meaning of life is. When you struggle, when the whole world is against you, or that evil businessman is trying to destroy your small business, or that crooked politician is trying to get you killed or thrown in jail or stealing things from you, and you fight against that, and you have to give up so much to win that battle, that's when the meaning of life comes to the fore. How often do you see movies or read good books about someone who goes to a government agency and get help? But on the other hand, when someone else volunteers their help or their resources to help that person, or if you see that person make it happen themselves, now that's a story worth seeing. That's a story you walk away from feeling really good. So it's important that we understand that these rights, the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to the pursuit of happiness, these are rights for the individual to make their own life from and to take their own action. It's not the right for someone else to make those things happen for them. No one can guarantee that your life will continue. All the government can try to do is prevent others from physically trying to take your life. No one can guarantee your liberty, but we can try to guarantee that the government or no one else can restrict your liberty from doing what you want to do. And no one can pursue your happiness for you or guarantee that you will be able to successfully pursue your happiness. There's a reason that they didn't say the right to happiness. They said the right to the pursuit of happiness, which means you can pursue it, and it will happen or it won't happen. And everyone's version of what will make them happy is different, so no one can really pursue that properly except the person that's trying to be happy. I'm going to take another break. I'll be back in a few minutes. Early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes in bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the red. Welcome back. This is Steve of Examine Life. And as I said earlier, Pat is not with us tonight. And a big hello out there to Pat. Here I am. I hope I'm not destroying our program. So we've been talking about the American Revolution, Independence Day, the point of the independence, why the people in America wanted to have independence. So I want to talk a little bit about the definition of words. Liberty, in the dictionary definition, is the state of being free within society from oppressive restrictions imposed by authority on one's way of life, behavior, or political views. For instance, compulsory retirement would interfere with individual liberty. An instance of this, a right or privilege, especially a statutory one. Another definition is the power or scope to act as one pleases. Those are the definitions of liberty. Freedom, the power to or right to act, speak, or think as one wants without hindrance or restraint, the absence of a subjection to foreign domination or despotic government, the state of not being imprisoned or enslaved, the state of being physically unrestricted and able to move easily, the state of not being subject to or affected by a particular or undesirable thing. Excuse me. The power of self-determination attributed to the will, the quality of being independent of fate or necessity. So freedom and liberty mean that you are in charge of your life. We have all these giant programs that are supposed to protect you from bad banks and bad home mortgage deals, and we've gotten to the point where people in America have this kind of unconscious idea that they're safe no matter what kind of a deal they make to buy the house or buy the car, and when the deal goes south, they want out of it because they made a bad choice. And it's because they didn't feel like they had to do their homework. So we need to, and we, in America, we need to become independent again. That was the point of America. Now, why do the United States of America is a great experiment in freedom. It was about the freedom to realize your wildest dreams. Some people have successfully done that. Some people have not. Look at the incredible financial success stories throughout our history. Sure, there have always been land barons, crooked politicians, crony capitalism, and a host of other evils. And the crony capitalism thing, what always amazes me is that there is a large group of people who believe that the way to fix this problem is to have the lawmakers make laws to prevent crony capitalism, not somehow thinking about the fact that one of the two cronies is the lawmaker. Now, how you expect them to fix this problem, I'm just not clear on that. I hope somebody will email me at examinelife@peoplepc.com and explain to me how that's going to happen. Anyway, look at the success stories of even the computer revolution of the last 40 years. Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg. Were these guys crooks? I mean, they're ultra rich. And I hear from a lot of people that if you're ultra rich, you obviously got that. You didn't do that. That was, you know, the community did that for you. If that's the case, I'm not sure why the community doesn't do it for everybody. But my question is, does anyone out there consider these guys to be crooks? Or are they unethical capitalist pigs? Look at the average income of the Hollywood elite. The vast riches of the Hollywood elite, are they... So many other Americans are out of work. So are the Hollywood elite and their money the reason that so many other Americans are out of work? Or is it just the rich business people who are evil? Another question I'd like someone to answer for me. Americans, you know, many Americans today, and there's probably a reason for that, don't like our country. They seem to think our country is one of the causes of evil in the world. And yet, think about the fact that Americans almost tore their nation apart when Abraham Lincoln and the new Republican Party took us to war to abolish the horrid practice of slavery. And later, the Republicans again fought against the Democrats to help black Americans finally gain their civil rights in a most peaceful way. Mostly peaceful. Doesn't that reveal the inherent goodness of our country? Think of the people who gave up their lives and the president that had to decide to almost tear the nation apart because this practice was so horrible. And, you know, the slavery kind of snuck into the country before it was a country because it wasn't a country. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of oversight. So these people came from the islands and they brought their slavery with them and it just kind of grew and it came to be an accepted thing. Doesn't mean it was acceptable. It means that it came to be an accepted thing to most of those people. And yet we as a nation, enough of us realized how terrible it was and people gave up their lives to stop it. When the United States proved to the world that it was the most powerful nation in existence during World War II, it was impervious at that point, at the end of that war. Did we conquer and ravage like most other nations had in their past? No, we didn't. America gave its own resources to help former enemies and friends alike regain their countries and their freedom and even their economies. None of us were there to remember that lived today, and few of us even bothered to study that history. But a great deal of the world was very glad that the powerful American military might was there to stop the advancement of fascism. And yet, again, America was the only one for a short period of time who had nuclear weapons. We were essentially unstoppable. And because of what America is, we use that power to bring the world back. We didn't use it to subjectivize the world. America has its flaws, as does every nation on earth. The American capitalist experiment created the greatest, most generous, most compassionate nation that has ever existed. Keeping that political power within the states and not the federal government was what kept the experiment alive and fresh during the first 100-150 years. There are countries and political systems all around the world. There are socialists, communists, dictatorships, monarchies, and everything in between. If a person doesn't believe in capitalism, then why not allow that person to move to a country with a political system that they believe is better? And work to improve that system. Why not let the capitalist country be capitalist and see if it ultimately fails? If one is so convinced that capitalism cannot succeed and they see more potential in a system such as socialism, then why not move to that place and live in the system that you believe in and help make it better? And in today's much smaller world, that's not a task as intimidating as it was taken by all those throughout history who've made the choice for capitalism and moved to America from the four corners of the world and given everything they have to get here because of what America is. And again, if you believe in fascism, there are still fascist countries around. There are monarchies run by kings. There are social democracies. There are socialists. There are communists. There are plenty of places where people can live. But if you truly believe that capitalism will inherently fail, why not prove that point by giving it free rein and watching it fail from a distance? Why try to change capitalism into something it's not? Because that way the argument can be made that it would have succeeded had you not tried to destroy it. So if it's that bad, let's go ahead and see if we can let it fail. If you're so convinced it can't succeed, then let it fail. I personally don't think it will, but I think, why not? I have some questions, too, about when you vote in elections. Why do we vote what we vote? When we vote for increasing a government program or for someone who promises they will, is it real generosity on our part to simply hand it off to government, who we know in our hearts will and always have screwed it up? Couldn't we each do the work and offer our excess, whatever it is, to those who are truly less fortunate? I mean, get involved and do the work, like people used to do. Should we do the work to vet each of the charitable institutions and give some of our own time and other resources to the honest institutions? Or we do think our lives are just too busy? Freedom means that each person acts as they wish within the law, but it also gives us the opportunity to help others as a choice, not by taxation. When we give of ourselves directly, we are more likely to see that the resources and time given are spent wisely and prudently. When you are one of those who makes a small enough income that you pay no taxes, let me ask you, do you vote for tax increases, or do you vote for people who believe in tax increases? Should you be voting for that if you are one who doesn't have to pay those taxes? I know I'm being a little harsh here to some, but I'm trying to ask honest questions. And let me remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of me, the program host, and the guests and participant, if any, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. So let me ask some questions here. Do you truly believe? Well, I'll tell you what. Let me take a break, and then I have a few more questions, and we'll end this show tonight. See you in a few minutes. a beautiful version of that song. That was, of course, America the Beautiful. I have some questions here that I'd like to ask at the end of the show. Anyone who's listening can email me at examinelife@peoplepc.com, and I'd like to see answers along with the logic behind the answers. For instance, do you truly believe or think that the politician is looking out for our best interests and not just looking out for their next re-election? Do you truly believe that the clear majority of those on disability are truly unable to do work of any kind? Do you truly believe that our universities are regions of free speech and the free exchange of ideas, that they want to listen to anyone and everyone's argument about what is right, what is wrong, what is intelligent, what is good for the human society, for the American society, the American culture? Do you really believe that our universities are a region of free speech? And if you don't, do you think it's a good thing that they're not? Do you truly believe that providing food, shelter, cell phones, and cash to people who are not working but are able to work will motivate them to do what they need to do to go back to the workforce and be willing to do what it takes to start again at the bottom and work their way up? I put the question that way because many people can be out of work for so long that they simply no longer have the presence needed to start where they left off. So, why not let America, as I said before, be America as it was designed? If you think the concepts that it is based upon are flawed, the least you can do is allow it to fail on its own principles so that in building the new America, we can learn from that failure. Now, again, some things like the Great Depression, people say, well, that was proof that the American capitalist system failed. The problem is that there was a fairly severe stock market crash a few years prior to that Great Depression. And the only difference was that the government didn't fix it. They told the private sector to fix it, so it recovered relatively quickly. The one in the 1930s, the 1929 stock market crash, the government decided to step in and help. And then basically what really ended that was World War II a decade later. And it's interesting to note that the percent of those who believe America is a seriously flawed country have risen in a linear fashion, starting from the time in the 1930s when federal governments began to be implemented. Again, let me explain that. Those who believe America is seriously flawed, the number of those people have kind of risen in a fashion that appears to be directly associated with the growth of the strength of the federal government over the state governments. And what I find particularly sad is that all of world history, including United States history, is at our fingertips. The World Wide Web has everything, and all the great classics are there for free. Everything is accessible. And yet, on a recent Man in the Street interview yesterday, a young adult was asked when we won our independence, and he answered 1984. I'll have to assume that our much-discussed educational system never encouraged him to read Orwell's book by the same name. This has been Examine Life. I'm Steve. And Pat wasn't with us tonight. Let me reiterate that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. KKRN is community-supported radio. Our number is 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. And you are the community, and you support the radio station. So if you have comments about our show, Examine Life at peoplepc.com, and we will see you on our next program. And we all hope that Pat is back with us, because I'm sure some people would probably appreciate that. So good night.